Welcome to Minute 27 of Movie Rob Minute, the daily podcast, where we take a wild trip through the 1987 John Hughes comedy, Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and once again, joining me today is Jim O'Kane of the Apollo 13 Minute, the Rocketeer Minute, and lots of other minutes, including a few collaborative projects that are going on as we speak. Welcome back to the show, Jim.
Thanks for having me on, Rob. I appreciate it very much. And it's interesting watching this film. We're in the least action filled week. But it's great character development and a lot of letting John Candy show his chops here. So I'm enjoying this particular minute that we're in.
I'm very happy to hear that. I mean, that's one of the pluses and minuses of Movies by Minute podcasts is that you will have episodes that are more dialogue driven and more action driven. It depends on the movie, obviously, but you know, you deal with it all.
Yeah, I remember my first podcast I was doing was for the 1970 movie Airport, and somewhere in the middle of it all, there's the airplane is landing, and there's just snow coming down outside of the front windows of the plane, and Dean Martin's looking out the window, and it starts with him saying the word Roger, and that's the whole minute. We're just looking out the window at snow, so. I think we might have had a meteorologist on to talk about snow at different altitudes, but I can't remember. It was one of those. How to cover this one is going to be a trick. But this looks good.
The first episode of the first minute of this movie also has one line of dialogue. So, but we still churned out, I think, a 45-minute episode. So we're good.
Yeah, just go large. That's all you can do. Let's get a bigger picture here.
Exactly. Completely. So. Yeah. Episode 27 begins with Dell beginning his retort to Neil from what we were discussing yesterday about his diatribe and ends with Neil contemplating how to actually react to everything that's going on. Okay, so yesterday we had the end of Neil's diatribe where he got pretty mean and basically we had Dell start to respond and he goes, yeah, you're right. I talk too much. I also listen too much. I could be a cold-hearted cynic just like you. But I don't like to hurt people's feelings. Well, you can think what you want about me. I'm not changing. I like me. My wife likes me. My customers like me. Because I'm the real article. What you see is what you get. And that's all the dialogue we have here. Again, it takes him a little while longer to get this dialogue out than Neil. When Neil gave his diatribe yesterday, he had a lot more to say within that minute. But he still takes his time with these 60 seconds and does a great job. Because it tells us so much about his personality, of who he is. Just these few little sentences.
As poignant as it could be, given what we find out about his wife later on in the film, but it's just, on rewatching it, you get more feelings about the depths of his, you know, what would otherwise be depression for him, and things that he holds on to in life. Candy really expresses the character here well. He stops being a cartoon, and you just want to hug the big lug, you know, as he's going through this, and you want to jump in and tell Steve Martin off, even though Martin's character is the organizing sensibility. I mean, we're supposed to identify with Steve Martin, but in this moment, we're feeling for Dell. He's our proxy.
Right.
We feel like, you know, good for him for standing up to him and explaining that he's going to be the real person that he is.
And the music here helps with that so much. I mean, the music is very emotional and makes everything feel a lot more real.
It's so impressive
with the way that it moves along.
I'm sure there are raw footage of this available. I would just love to see how many takes because this. Seems like it would be very draining to act this way in front of a
especially
camera.
Especially for comedians.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Just being able to bring pathos to it. Very tough on there.
Yeah. And I mean, Dell does a great job by showing how much emotion he has in this whole thing. He's on the one hand trying to hold back, but he still knows that he needs to respond. And when he's finished with what he says, he just finishes the speech and sits down on the bed. And basically says, you know, screw you. I'm going to continue acting the way that I have always acted because that's the right way to do it. And I don't care what you think.
Yeah.
You know, and I found it interesting that he calls him a cold-hearted cynic.
Yeah.
You know, that's an interesting – because, again, as we mentioned the end of last week, when Del talked back to Neil, he basically doesn't, he keeps his tone down to a pleasant tone. You know, he doesn't start calling people names. He doesn't start cursing or anything like that. He still speaks in a very wholesome manner, I guess you can say. So to call him a cold-hearted cynic, it shows also that this is, he's educated. He's not just some guy off the street. You know, he knows what he's saying and why he's saying.
We've seen in the past, you know, he has all these friends. Del has friends everywhere. So he didn't get that way by being nasty, by being cynical. All these people care about him enough to give him a hotel room when there are no hotel rooms the day before Thanksgiving and things. And just, he's a likable guy who everybody sees except for Steve Martin, who, you know, it's how he doesn't understand that this guy, even though he might be loud, he might be he takes up all the air in the room. If there's a problem with Del, it's Steve Martin's problem. It's not his problem. He's not, you know, everybody right. else seems to get along with him. So.
Correct. I mean, when you go deeper into the script, you see some of the ways of how he knows people. I mean, you mentioned the fact that he was able to get this room from Gus. Okay. In the original script, Gus mentions that the reason the room wasn't rented out is because someone died in it the night before. And then he mentions the name of the guy who died, and Del actually knows who that was.
Wow.
You know, which again shows that Del is very personable and knows everyone around. He's, you know, he's the Norm of Cheers.
Yeah.
In this movie.
Yeah. And I think about the famous author and basically a social engineer, Dale Carnegie. Dale Carnegie wrote the book How to Win Friends and Influence People. And the number one rule that Dale Carnegie stressed was that if you express a sincere interest in the lives of others, you will win other people's friendship, because everybody's favorite topic is themselves. So I think that what you see in Dale is he does express a sincere interest. You can try to fake interest, but if you actually are sincere about it, people are drawn to that idea that you want to be, you want to know about them. You want to hear about their favorite topic, which is themselves. And I think, Neil doesn't get that. He thinks everything is transactional. You know, I have to do this so that you'll give me this. But really, if it grows up organically, as Del's found, you make friends and they do things for you without having to ask.
Right, exactly. There's no question about that. I mean, that's the main difference between the two of them. You know, you can also look at it from that they both have different social standings. You know, you have one of them is a high class person. I mean, Neil is, you know, you see his house, you see that he was supposed to fly first class and everything, and then you see Del, who, even though he has his expenses probably paid by his company, he's still doing things in a modest way in order to get his job done. Because he enjoys himself. He enjoys what he's doing. He enjoys meeting all these people.
Yeah, and that's his compensation in life, is that he has all these friends across the country. And you know, it's very odd, because Steve Martin's character is in advertising and he should be understanding how to persuade people. He spends all that time at the beginning where he's waiting out his boss or his client/boss
client.
That between two different things, and he doesn't understand that being impatient and being frustrated with things doesn't sell your product, which his product is to selling other people on persuasion, which he's very bad at.
Right. Well, again, in Neil's defense, we don't know specifically what his job is in the advertising campaign. You know, it is possible that he's not the idea man. It's possible that he's there. Maybe the guy who he's with, John Dole, you know, for Bueller's father. Or as we realized, it can't be Ferris Bueller's father, but maybe it's his uncle, or maybe he just changed his name to protect himself so that people wouldn't say, oh, you're Ferris's father. Who knows?
Yeah. It's just like, even if he wasn't the idea guy, he still has to be like the customer support guy. He seems to be some kind of a product manager or client manager that has to know how to deal with people.
Right.
And of the two people, Dell is definitely the man for the job. If you're going to find somebody that's going to sell shower rings, I mean, picturing trying to market that, he's the man. He's probably the number one man in the country that can sell shower rings to, you know, hotels or wherever.
And people just in bus stations.
Yeah, exactly. No, new earrings and stuff. it's an interesting dive into the personalities by just comparing how they respond to life.
Right, because each of these two characters have a completely different perspective on everything. I mean, that's one of the great things about this entire scene in the motel. You have these two people coming from completely different situations, and they're both looking at it that they're in the right here and the other one is in the wrong. But the way that it's all presented to us is we can see both their viewpoints and empathize with both of them and not know who we're supposed to be rooting for here.
I agree. And it's Neil doesn't have much of, he doesn't have much slack in his rope. He's stretched very much. If he's not first class, if he's not staying at the Hilton, he's put upon. But Dell carries around a steamer trunk and is happy enough to get into a travel lodge at, you know, if there's a roof over his head, he has it made. So it's interesting just the juxtaposition of those two walks of life, especially during, and Hughes does this a lot because he feels the pressure is during holiday times. I mean, you think about National Lampoon's Vacation, or you think about, he wrote Home Alone. These things, family and things that are normally pleasant that you think of as pleasant, family and holidays, for people in the John Hughes universe, that's the most stressful time of all. And
completely.
You know, and you just wonder if it's that bad at a time when you're supposed to be happy, what's it like on, you know, what's it like in the middle of July or something, or, you know, wherever you're not having family get togethers or seeing people, do these people live like this, you know, 24/7, 365 a year? It's
right.
But, you know, again, all this gets compressed down into this interaction that we're seeing in this minute, the surrounding minutes.
Yeah, that's true. So I just want to point a few things out that happened in this minute that are a little interesting. Now, last week we had a whole long discussion about pillows, and we talked about the fact that Dell has his own pillow that he uses, and there's continuity errors here because there are time. I mean, my first question last week was that if Dell is not using the pillow from the motel, so that would mean that Neil should have two pillows. He should have given him his pillow, but he didn't. Neil is only on one pillow. So at this point, we once again see that Dell's pillow is there and there is no other pillow underneath. Okay. We'll get to that later in the week because that pillow will reappear for some strange reason, you know,
all in support of the plot.
Of course. And this is also the very first mention of Dell's wife. I mean, we saw pictures of Marie when he got into the motel, and we see it in this minute also because we have her picture prominently on the nightstand, you know, for him to always look at, knowing what her fate is by having seen the movie before. It changes things a little bit by him saying this phrase, because he says it in the present tense, my wife likes me. You know, he doesn't say my wife liked me, or, you know, he still is, I guess maybe he's somewhat in denial that she's no longer around.
Yeah, or that he has to maintain this appearance so that people don't, I mean, maybe he's trying to dissuade others from grieving for him. It's one of those, I'll get into a personal story. My first wife, died when my children were very young. And, one of the things that my kids have had difficulties with in relationships is, no matter what relationship you get into, eventually you have to drop what my what my family calls the mom bomb. You have to tell people about about these circumstances, and you have to like lead them through grief. They'll say, "Oh, I'm so sorry for you. What a terrible thing to happen now. You know, how what was like when you were growing up, blah 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 blah." So anytime they meet somebody new, they know that sometime they're going to have to drop the mom bomb, and then you know, you have to set aside time and say, okay, we're going to talk about this, and then we don't have to talk about it anymore because I've lived through it, and this was years ago, and you know, you're at a different stage in processing all this stuff. So I think about this. This is like the Marie bomb, that he doesn't want to drop the Marie bomb because then he's going to have to console Neil over things that he didn't want to get into. He doesn't want to chat about. So I can feel that part that he just says, well, they don't have to know that, you know, my wife is no longer with us. And, and then that became a habit with him. And I think that's, you know, this is the first time that pops up in the script, but it's, you know, this is just his way of dealing with not having to deal with other people, having to deal with
one of the things that we mentioned a few weeks ago when the picture actually popped up in the motel room, I think this was 2 weeks ago when we discussed it. So in the original script, it actually says that the picture is somewhat faded and looks like it's years old, which obviously the picture that we see isn't that way, but it's interesting that in the script, it already gives a little bit of a hint to the fact that this is not a recent picture.
Yeah, this is from his past, not from his present. And he never calls her or anything.
Or we don't see that he calls her. I mean, there are things going on that we're not going to see, obviously. All right, do you have anything else you want to say about this particular minute?
No, a short minute, but a great one. I mean, it's it really gives us more insight.
Well, it's still 60 seconds.
Yeah, I know, but there's some minutes that drag on forever. You're like, oh my gosh, how am I going to – at least you're not saying Roger and looking at the snow, so that's –
Exactly. Yeah. That's true. That's very true. All right. So in the script, it's a very small discrepancy. So basically when Del is talking, he says, "I like people, Neil. I even like you." They add in that little phrase by him also saying that he likes Neil. And then he says, "People are my business. They're my business because I've made them my business." That also adds a little bit more to the character. I'm curious as to why they cut those particular lines out. And then at the end, when he talks about the fact that he says, "Because I'm the real article, I'm a human being." And then he says, "Flaws, fat, and farts. I'm flesh and blood." So I can understand why they cut that out, because it's just not
me. And it's probably also not how he'd talk. He kind of just rolls through life he's a salesman for himself all the time. So I don't think he'd want to be, you know, either rude or even impolite. He's very, very straightforward in most of these things. So, and plus, you know, as you said before, the movie ran 4 hours. You got to get something somewhere. You might as well get a couple of paragraphs off the bottom of it.
That's true. It's very true.
But yeah, again, more insight into the character.
Yeah, completely. So every day we do another segment called Off the Beaten Track, where myself or my guest will give a little adventure or misadventure that happened to us somewhere throughout our lives. So Jim, why don't you give us another Off the Beaten Track story for us?
Okay, let's set the Wayback Machine for May of 1969. Apollo 10 is launching at the Kennedy Space Center. And my parents and I are at a Holiday Inn in Cocoa Beach, Florida, just south of the Kennedy Space Center. And it's springtime in Florida, which is like 80, 90 degrees. And there's a pool, and I'm 9 years old and have off from school for a couple of days to go watch the launch. And I'm down there swimming in the pool. And this older fellow comes out with a towel, throws it on a one of those lounge chairs, and starts doing laps in the pool back and forth and back and forth. And I'm not doing laps. I'm just splashing around the pool. And all of a sudden, the guy was, you know, I didn't realize I was in his lane where it's a hotel pool. It doesn't have lanes, but he's just plowing away, and he banged into me, and I said, "I'm sorry, I'm sorry, I'm sorry." And then he stood up in the pool to see what he had hit, and he found it hit me, and it turned out it was CBS newsman Walter Cronkite, who was down covering the launch of Apollo 10.
And wow.
I was like, "It's Walter Cronkite." And CBS News at the time they kind of permanently rented out a couple of hotel rooms in the hotel, and they actually had put in gold leaf CBS news on the windows of this hotel in Cocoa Beach. So that was my literal run-in with Walter Cronkite at during the launch of Apollo 10. I didn't see him after that until many years later. I was going to school in Manhattan or in the Bronx at Fordham University, and I was writing on media history. And I was writing about CBS move toward color television in the 50s, and I was going into the CBS headquarters to talk with one of their engineers who had worked on the original CBS Color, and I'm cutting across this very large there's a kind of a patio. A long plaza in front of CBS. The office is known as Black Rock because it's made out of black granite. So I'm walking into Black Rock, and this other guy is coming toward me, and I noticed it's Walter Cronkite, and this is.
And he probably said, "Oh, you're the kid that bothered me when I was trying to take a swim."
I said to him, "Mr. Cronkite, we met when I was back at Apollo 10. You were swimming," and he looked at me and he said, "Oh," and then he walked past me and got in a car. But I don't know if he remembered me. I remembered it, but I don't know how many kids he's bumped into in pools over time. But it was interesting seeing him so many years later after our little run in. So anyway, That's my.
That's a great one. Thank you very much. So why don't you once again tell people how they can get in touch with Jim O'Kane?
Well, if you want to hear all of my different podcasts, they are easily found at jimokane.com, JIMOKANE.com. I've got links to all my older podcasts, and including the current one, which is the group project. I'm acting as producer for the Silverado Minute, where we go over Lawrence Kasdan's film, me and 26 of my best friends, doing this all as kind of a Whitman sampler of Movies by Minutes host, doing 1 week each or 5 minutes of the Lawrence Kasdan film. So check that out. It's available at SilveradoMinute.com.
All right. Excellent. And while you're doing that, you can go rate, review, and subscribe on any podcatcher you might be using to listen to this show. And to find me, just do a quick search for Movie Rob Minute. You can find me on Facebook. You can find my website. You can find me on Twitter. So, Jim, you want to come back in tomorrow?
Sounds good.
All right. Excellent. So, until tomorrow, you're
fucked. Basically, you're fucked.